This is the Pet Podcast on pets.ca, episode number 49, all about pets and cancer. Hey there, pet lovers. How's it going? And welcome to the 49th Pet Podcast on pets.ca. My name is Marco, and as always, we're coming to you from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. For today's show, we have an interview with Dr. Lee, and today we're going to talk about pets and cancer. We actually opened up this interview session to bulletin board members, and we asked them for questions they wanted answered, and we chose one by Sugar Cat Mom, wanting to know some general information about pets and cancer, what we can do about it, treatments, signs, and symptoms. And of course, Dr. Lee is so gracious, he's obliged us, and he's going to answer that question in an interview that's going to follow very shortly. Before we get into the interview, I'd like to thank people for some emails that they sent with regard to our last podcast, where we opened it up to the bulletin board members, and Tenderfoot Training, Doug and Elizabeth Simpson of Tenderfoot Training, answered a couple of questions from our bulletin board members, and thanks so much for the feedback. It was positive, and as always, we love to get feedback, so if you want to respond straight in the blog, that might be the best way. Just go to pets.ca/blog, and then just click the comments tab, which is at the top of every post. Be it a blog post or a podcast post. You can also send me emails directly, of course, pets.ca@gmail.com. And of course, you can also give any type of feedback you want in the forums as well. The forums are pretty popular, so if you are a pet lover and you want some information, we absolutely encourage people to join our community. We're very open to everyone as long as people are friendly, but people should know in advance that the majority of us are very pro spay and neuter. Okay, the actual interview with Dr. Lee is almost 30 minutes long. It's one of our longer podcasts, so let's just get right into it now. So I'd like to welcome back Dr. Lee to our podcast. Dr. Lee has been a regular guest, as our regular listeners well know. Today we're going to try something a little bit different. Normally we have a topic selected beforehand, but this time we thought we would open it up to the members. So we opened up a thread in the bulletin board, and quite a few people posted. And we're going to choose one of the questions to answer. But before we do, welcome back, Dr. Lee. Glad to have you back.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Always a pleasure. So unfortunately, a few members chose questions that we already covered. We're going to choose a question by Sugar Cat Mom, and I'll just read it now. I'd be interested in a podcast on cancer. Pretty broad topic, I know, but maybe something regarding symptoms to look out for, treatment protocols, or some of the more common cancers affecting our pets. So we think this is a good topic, Dr. Lee and I, and the question itself also brings forth an answer right away. So I thought let's just leave it to you, Dr. Lee. What's the first thing that comes to mind after hearing a question like that?
I think it's an excellent question, and it's something that certainly a lot of people get worried about. We do see this, unfortunately, in a lot of different types. One thing that I think is interesting about the question, which is something that so many people will ask, is what are the symptoms to look out for? And I think one of the most misleading things about cancer is that there is not a specific symptom. The symptoms can range from absolutely nothing, and the pet can be completely what we call asymptomatic or have no clinical signs, and yet we have a very aggressive cancer progressing very quickly, and we're already very much behind the game when we already have or without clinical signs. And then there are some situations where we will see clinical signs. I mean, there's a lot of dogs, like Rottweilers, for example, that are, and Sighthounds, that are predisposed to bone cancer. You know, limping will be one of the first things that we'll see. So sometimes there are specific symptoms, but more often than not, we will see vague symptoms or no symptoms at all.
At some point, though, you know, cancers are a pernicious thing. There's got to be some symptoms as the cancer progresses. How does that vary with different cancers? Is that statement at all true? Or are there sometimes no symptoms at all until the very end?
We have to kind of qualify, like, where do we put that end? You know, and I think for a lot of pet owners, and certainly my feeling is that when there is that point of no return and there's nothing that we can do to either help quality or quantity of life, that can be an end. And certainly at that point sometimes does get reached, sometimes with very little clinical signs, where we have such a spread that by the time we recognize There's not a lot that we can do. The end, as far as, you know, the actual demise of the patient, that will certainly, there will be a number of signs that we will start to see before that. But again, those can range quite a bit. There are certain masses that will spread to the lymph nodes. Others will spread to the lungs. Some will spread to the brain. Others to the liver or other internal organs. So depending on which type of cancer we have, it will determine where we are spreading. And where we spread is going to determine what those final symptoms are going to be.
I know this is the most basic question, but what is cancer actually?
Our cells are constantly dividing and reproducing, and then there are other, and then there are also cells that are, we actually have a program for death within a cell, and it's part of our normal process. And that way, we always have a balance. As the older cells are programmed through what's called apoptosis or cell death, that programmed cell death, then we have other cells that are programmed to divide and make up that difference. So we're always in a state of having a similar number of cells. With cancer, what will happen is that the genes for replication go haywire, and they just continue to multiply. And so what you have is unregulated cell reproduction. And so you have these cells just reproducing without any plan or order.
And when these cells reproduce, is it this reproduction of cells that causes masses or tumors?
Right, because the mass or the tumor is just going to be a conglomeration of cells, then as those cells are multiplying without any type of design, that is cancer. And then we find out then why that becomes such a wide range of clinical signs and why so many cancers are different. Is we have to look at where is that cell originating from. You know, there's so many different types of tissues and organs in the body. For every different type of cell in the body, there's a different type of cancer. So that's why there are thousands of different types of cancers. Then we get into the two main differences is between, we have local tumors and then metastatic tumors. Locally aggressive cancers are going to be masses that they're reproducing and where this mass is enlarging, but it's not going anywhere. It's just staying in that one area. So if we can get rid of that group of cells in that one location, then we can get a cure. The other type of cancer is typically more aggressive, and metastatic means that it's going to transfer or move throughout the body. And with metastatic tumors, we're having those cells and they're reproducing in that area. And then little cells just kind of break off and move on down either through the lymphatic tissue or through the bloodstream. And they just, wherever they fall and sit, they start to reproduce again. And so you start getting these distant locations of the masses.
That's really good basic information. And I have one more question, if you don't mind. It seems, at least to me and likely for many people, it might be easier to grasp a tumor just because it's physical and things are growing, as opposed to something more obscure, let's say blood cancer or leukemia. How does a cancer like leukemia differ from cancers that produce tumors?
It's a good question. Leukemia, it is still creating masses. The problem is that you're dealing with the whole lymphatic chain. And so I guess I just need to step back a bit and just quickly define lymph nodes for everybody.
Please.
The lymphatic tissue is a whole network of tissue in the body that helps. It's part of our immune system, and it's kind of part of the cleanup crew. When we take a look at blood, we think of, you know, arteries pump all the blood to the cells, and veins pump all the blood back. And that's not entirely true. Arteries do pump all the blood in, but veins probably only take about 9% of that blood back. What is left is there is these cells, after they get the nutrients from the blood, they will have waste that just oozes out of the cells. And those will go through these ducts, which are very difficult to see even under the microscope, but they'll follow these paths into lymph nodes. And these lymph nodes are basically groups of our immune system or high amounts of white blood cells, which take care of all of this type of cellular garbage. And as it moves through the body, it slowly dumps it back into the bloodstream after it's been processed and cleaned up. It's kind of a recycling center, if you will. So because it's part of our cleanup crew, it's very common for cancers to go to the lymph nodes. And the reason is you get these little cancer cells that are breaking off outside of where the mass is. Body doesn't really know what to do with it, and it goes right up into the recycling center of the body. And then it starts to germinate and grow right inside that area. Leukemia, which is kind of sort of a variation of lymphoma, it has to do with where the cancer started, is a cancer of the lymphatic tissue. And so instead of being a tumor that has gone to the lymph node tissue or the lymphatic tissue, it's actually a cancer that arises out of the lymphatic tissue.
Actually, I'm slightly confused. So if you could just clarify. So I thought lymphoma is cancer of the lymph nodes. I thought leukemia was cancer of the of blood cancer, particularly white blood cell cancer. How far off of that generalization is that?
That is true. They are connected.
Okay.
Those, because the white blood cells are kind of intimately connected with the lymph nodes and the lymphatic tissue, that typically you'll have, there will be a crossover. There is a difference, but
there's also some overlap, I guess.
There's overlap.
So just curious again, they are producing masses, but they're too small to see. I mean, it certainly differs from a traditional mass that you'll see, you know, an untreated cancer patient, a dog or a cat just has this, you know, massive tumor hanging on them. So it is still producing tumors, but they're very small. They're located differently. We can't see them.
If you're talking about like a leukemia where you just have the white blood cells in the bloodstream and we're not dealing with the lymph nodes, then yes, I guess you can say that there's not an actual mass sitting there. But you have still a large number of cells being produced. But instead of being in one discrete area, they're kind of circulating through the bloodstream. Typically, those will end up falling into the lymph nodes, and so you do get lymph node involvement, and then you end up getting lymphoma. They're classified differently based upon kind of where the problem originated. I would say that in human medicine, I see it separated. In veterinary medicine, a lot of times it ends up getting collectively grouped.
Thanks so much for clearing that up. I guess I'd like to, again, back to the symptoms thing. Depending on different cancers, there will be different symptoms. How do people prevent it? People know that early detection of cancer is typically the best way to fight cancer. Sometimes we say there's no symptoms until it's critical. How do we know what's going on? How do we screen for this? How do we prepare for it? How do we eliminate it? How do we prevent it? You know, how can we allay the fears that people have with the word cancer for our pets? Is there really anything we can do?
There's a lot that we can do. Again, it's a good question. I mean, it's something that, you know, it always we get concerned about. And I certainly know that when I see a client that brings in an older animal and they're sick, you can see the worry on the people's face that this is what they're worried about. And, you know, a lot of times it's exactly what I'm worried about, too, for their pet. Because it has such a wide presentation and it can happen with any cells, and it can happen with any age. Just like with, you know, people, there will be kids that will get, you know, lymphoma as a child. And then there will be adults that get that as well. One of my great uncles died of lymphoma. And it's one of those things, so we'll see it both in young and old. It's always something that we need to look out for, because if we can find it, the earlier we detect it, the more options that we have for it. Sometimes with older dogs, we will just do x-rays of the chest and abdomen. Those are, you know, excellent screening tools to try to look for those masses. The blood work, a lot of times in people, there are blood tests for different cancers like prostatic cancer. We don't have those options as much in veterinary medicine. blood work is always an important screening tool. There are some changes that we will see on the blood tests for masses and cancers, but in general, blood work is not the best place to start. And that's where, you know, x-rays are x-rays and a physical exam. Those are probably the two best things that we can do as screening. For older dogs, if we're worried about it, running those screening tests is a very good way of looking out for it. One of the things, too, I'd like to just touch upon, and I was kind of heading before my discussion, was a lot of times when we see, once we hear the cancer word, then we immediately think that we need, that that's it. There's nothing more that we can do, and we need to think about putting the pet down. And that is, that's really not the case. There's a lot that we can do for cancer. There's a lot of things, there's a lot of pets that can lead very good, happy lives despite having cancer. And one of the interesting things is that while older pets are more commonly going to get cancer, they are going to typically have less aggressive forms versus having that same form in a younger pet.
That's interesting, actually.
Yeah, so it doesn't mean that if your older dog gets cancer, it's not aggressive, but it is going to be much less so aggressive than in a younger person. Again, I think about this with, like, my great uncle. When he had lymphoma, he was able to be very happy for many, many, many years. He did very well with it. I also had a friend who, she died of breast cancer at 26, and it was very, very aggressive despite what everyone could do. And I see that in pets as well. When we do see the 2-, 3-, 4-year-old dogs that are getting cancers, you know, those we do need to be very aggressive. And so when I see a mass on a young pet, even though it just looks like a small skin tumor, it is something that we do need to be careful of, and something that, you know, we don't want to be dismissive of. Doesn't mean that we need to biopsy every single, you know, mass that comes our way, but it does mean that we need to bring every single mass to the attention of our vet so they can help us determine whether or not this is a mass we need to biopsy or not. Because on these younger pets, we cannot waste any time trying to get a diagnosis. But on these older pets, when they do have it, it is not necessarily a death sentence. We can make them very happy, and chemotherapy can work very well. And it's very different than how it is with people. Again, I've put two of my personal dogs through chemotherapy, and I've also had, again, as I said, a very good friend of mine who, she went through chemotherapy when she was 26. Having gone through those experiences, it was very difficult to watch my friend go through it. Having put two of my dogs through it, my one dog who died from cancer, I was doing chemotherapy, and he was still hiking out in the mountains about 3 weeks before we ended up having to put him down. So he was still having he didn't know what was going on. He was still having a very good quality of life.
That's a really important point, and thanks for sharing a bit of that personal information with us. You know, we often just get freaked out about the word, the C word, you know, and especially in humans, we can see indeed, and you went through it, how terrible it can be. But dogs and humans are different. Cats and humans are different. We don't experience things in the same way. And, you know, the treatment doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, that terrible scenario that we'll see in real life and in movies. You actually mentioned chemotherapy, and it was also part of Sugar Cat Mom's question. Maybe we could talk about just some other general treatments as well. And is there a difference in the treatment between, as you just mentioned, a young dog that gets cancer versus an elderly dog that already has cancer? Is chemotherapy one of the key treatments, are there others?
There are others. And again, that's why, as we talked about, because every cell in the body, you know, and every cell type can be unique from others, because each one can become cancer, it is very important to know that there is, you know, such a wide treatment. And one of the things, too, and I think coming back, and it's the C word, the cancer word is so, you know, you touched on a good point. It's so dangerous because we throw it out there, and all of a sudden, you know, we have this Hollywood image of it. It is important to know that there are things like hyperthyroidism in cats and Cushing's disease in dogs. Those can technically be defined as cancer. It is a functional tumor. It is a tumor of the thyroid or pituitary or adrenal gland. And those masses, those cells are replicating without proper control. There's too much of that functional tissue available, and that's leading to too much creation of this hormone. But that's not a word that we typically think about with those diseases, because if we said it, you know, a lot of these animals may end up being put down. When we don't, what we're doing is just controlling the effects of these the hormones that are being released from the glands. So it is a very wide range, and there are some types of, you know, cancers, things like pituitary tumors, that we're not going to be doing, you know, what we would typically think of as chemotherapy. There are other tumors, you know, that are into cancers that sometimes you don't need to do anything at all. It's technically, it's a mass. It may be locally aggressive, but there are some types that if they're not bothering the pet, they can stay where they are. Many tumors we need to do chemotherapy with. Some tumors do not really respond well to chemotherapy, and they may just be surgical. Some are going to be a combination of surgery and chemo. And then there's also things like radiation therapy. So there's a wide range. There's also a lot of holistic options. I think that there's been a lot of advances in the realm of nutrition. There's been a diet out there that has been shown in any type of aggressive tumor while the patients are undergoing chemo that it will increase their life expectancy by 17%. And that's just with the diet change. So there's a lot of different options out there. I think the key is that we need to identify what type of mass it is. And if it is something that, you know, we are considering cancer, I think we need to consult with an oncologist, because every case is going to be different. We're going to have to deal with not only the cell type, but the location. Do we have spread? Do we have other concurrent disorders? And what's the overall health of that patient? Both dogs that I've put through chemotherapy, I went through oncologists with. It's not something that I just went alone.
That's great information, Dr. Lee. Quick question about chemotherapy. We hate to talk about expense, but it is a reality for a lot of people. As pet lovers that have gone to veterinarians and have paid for surgeries and things like that, we know it can add up. Can you give us a rough idea of what chemotherapy costs?
Again, another good question. Chemotherapy is also one of those areas that it is as broad as the masses are. And so one of the things, too, that we look at is that there's different levels of chemotherapy, there's different options, and sometimes the term is broad and sometimes confusing. There are some patients that what we will be doing is putting them just on prednisone. Technically, that's chemotherapy. There's a lot of dogs that are on prednisone for allergies and a whole sort of different disorders. And so we don't typically think of it as that big of a deal because it's not, you know, very expensive. I mean, a month's worth of prednisone is going to be under $20. But in some cases, we're actually doing that in the mode of chemotherapy. So sometimes it does not have to be that expensive. On the other hand, yes, it can sometimes run into, you know, thousands of dollars. One of my dogs is taking to the oncologist. I was spending a few hundred every month. That was after the initial surgery. He went through two different surgeries, and I think that was probably in the realm of a couple grand. So it was a combination of both surgery and chemotherapy.
I mean, that's good to know. But again, we don't want to freak people out. You know, as we just mentioned, you know, it can be that expensive. We know it can be at the worst case scenario. But like you just mentioned, some treatments are often way cheaper than that. So we don't really want pet owners to freak out the second they hear the C word.
Right. It's also what your veterinarian is there for. There's a lot of vets out there that can do chemotherapy. You know, I have quite a number of patients that I do chemotherapy for. I always recommend that they go to the oncologist, you know, first. You know, sometimes it's chemotherapy that has to be done with the oncologist. a lot of times it's something that once we get a plan with the oncologist, they can end up coming back. And, you know, my other dog, I did all the chemotherapy myself. And again, there's a range, and it doesn't mean that we always have only one plan. Even with, you know, cancer, again, I do think that getting an oncologist involved as quickly as possible, if only for just a consult and some peace of mind of what, where we think we're at, I think that's a very good idea. But once we're there, you know, we need to talk to both the oncologist and a normal vet and say, look, this is what is realistic for me, and this is what I feel comfortable with. And usually we can figure something out that works for all members of the family and the pocketbook.
Yeah, a very good point. You know, the peace of mind is really a big thing as well. And, you know, unfortunately, some people don't want to deal with stuff. And when they hear the C word, they just don't want to deal with stuff. But, you know, especially from our perspective as big time pet lovers, you know, it's far better to know what the reality is than to walk around not wanting to know what reality is, because sometimes the treatment can indeed not be as scary as you think it is.
Exactly. And sometimes, you know, again, the cancer word is so broad in its meaning that a lot of times, too, I think that, you know, as healthcare professionals, we are so used to sometimes seeing or hearing that word. That word's come up, you know, definitely make sure that that becomes clarified so you know that you're on that same page.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. I'm going to let you go very shortly, but I did have one more question for you. Before I pose that question, I just wanted to suggest to people that maybe pet insurance is a good thing to avoid these, you know, these possible bad scenarios. And it leads me actually into my last question about the incidence of these things. I mean, I don't know if you have actual numbers on these things, but just in your experience, how often do you come across dogs and cats that have cancer in your practice? Is it a daily, a weekly, a monthly thing? How often does it happen? How many should we expect the average pet to die from cancer eventually? How often does it occur?
Well, the good news is that, you know, cancer in the U.S. in people is going down. The number, the overall statistics of percentages with people seems to be going down, and it also seems to be going with a similar trend with pets. So we are seeing, you know, some decrease, but I would say that, you know, cancer is something I talk about daily. Diagnosis, again, because we're talking about that broad term, you could say that I diagnose it weekly. Maybe if we're looking at the cases that are the dramatic, there's nothing that we can possibly do about it. That's probably not even monthly. Certainly some form of cancer is cropping up on a weekly basis.
I mean, that's good to know, because people ultimately, they want the best for their pets. And, you know, if things have a lower incidence level, then they can worry about them less. But cancer is not one of those things. Lots of pets get cancer, different types of cancers. And it's for this reason that when we notice that our pets are not acting normally, not even necessarily, you know, feeling them, but when they're not acting normally, that's the time to bring them into the vet and hope it's not cancer, but at least bring them in when you notice they're not acting normally.
I think that sounds like great advice.
So thanks so much for that, Dr. Lee. I know a lot of people are going to be listening to this particular podcast because it is such a fear for so many people. And at the very least, I think, you know, we've brought some very important points that people can discuss with their own veterinarians when people are concerned about the possibility that their pet might have some form of cancer. So thanks as always, Dr. Lee, for this great information. And we know we'll be speaking to you again in the next short while.
I appreciate it. It's always good talking to you.
Thanks again, Dr. Lee. And I'd like to thank Dr. Lee once again for that great information, always gracious with his time and his information. If you'd like to check out Dr. Lee's site, it's in progress, but he has a new site at acerlux.com. Links, of course, to go in the show notes. And on that site, he has extra information and links to the pet podcasts we record, so I do encourage you to check it out. If you like this podcast, perhaps the easiest way to get it is by subscribing in any of the links on the front page of the blog. That's pets.ca/blog. We had a small problem a couple of weeks ago and one of our feed links wasn't working, but it's working now. So the best way to get these automatically is through a podcatcher like iTunes or Google Reader. Links to those are going to go in the show notes as well. And basically, all you have to do is download Google Reader or download iTunes. And then once those are downloaded to your computer, when you click on any of those links on the front page of our blog, you will get intuitive prompts and you just click a couple of buttons and it's done. If you ever have any problems, it's more than my pleasure to help anyone. Just send me an email, pets.ca@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. As always, before we end, I like to encourage people to hug their pets even more. Give them rubs, kisses, massages, spend some time with them, and just before you're done, give them an extra scratchy under the chin from Marco. Bye for now, everyone.